Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we introduce today's guest, I want to be sure that we thank our sponsor, OneCause. OneCause is the leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's 12-month recovery plan that we've been collaborating on for the last several weeks with several of our most trusted colleagues in the fundraising space. We are very grateful to Jennifer Harris, Andrew Olson, Teresa Lee, as well as our friends at OneCause and iWave for contributing to this plan. This resource is available to you for free. All you have to do is go to our website at www.responsivefundraising.com/recovery plan and download it. I will also be sure to include a link in the show notes. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, podcast listeners. I am delighted to have two guests with me today, actually co-host and guest with me today. Teresa, why don't I hand this over to you, let you introduce yourself as our co-host, as a member of the Responsive team, and then I'll let you introduce Ricardo.
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Teresa Lee, and I am a senior consultant with Responsive Fundraising. My headquarters is in the Northeast in Massachusetts, representing New England for Responsive. And I'm delighted to be here today. I asked Ricardo Di Capua to join us for a conversation. Ricardo, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, but before you do that, I want to let our listeners know how I know you and why you're on the podcast here with us today. So Ricardo and I met when he was, or is, both an alumnus and a volunteer for MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I worked there in the Alumni Association and connected with him over his desire to make a gift, which I'm going to have him talk about. And then Ricardo went on to be a wonderful volunteer for MIT in many, many ways that I think will be interesting to our listeners to understand and get the viewpoint both of a donor and a very experienced volunteer on a lot of levels in fundraising. So Ricardo, if you would, why don't you give our listeners your background and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you, Teresa. Thank you for inviting me. Jason, thank you very much. I've had the pleasure of working with Teresa, and I use the word pleasure literally because it's been very enjoyable working together and getting good results for many, many years. My current position, occupation, is I run a family office, mostly involved in private equity, managing private equity. Before that, I had started up quite a few companies during the internet age and ran those companies. And before that, I started and ran manufacturing companies in South America. My degrees are in science and engineering from MIT and in business from the Harvard Business School, both in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And that's my background. My wife and I live in South Florida now. We've lived here for 30 years now. And that's a very, very brief summary of my position.
I think there's a little bit more to it. You came to MIT from where?
I came to MIT from Colombia, South America. And the way I got there was that I was very much a child nerd, of course, building computers in the garage. there was an issue of Scientific American magazine in September 1966. It was a single topic issue devoted to computers. And so I wrote all the authors of the articles in the magazines saying, if I want to study computers, where should I go to college? And absolutely all of them replied, which was a very nice thing. In those days, you send letters by mail and you got replies by mail. And all of them mentioned MIT, plus there was Cornell and Stanford and let's say two or three others. So I applied to MIT, got accepted, and that is how I went to MIT. That is how I got started with my MIT connection.
Now, so I got a notice one day that you'd called MIT and wanted to make a gift. And I called you back and we had a wonderful conversation about what you wanted to do and why you wanted to do it. And I think it's an interesting story for our listeners to hear about because it informs for us our work about matching a donor's vision and passion to a purpose at our institution. So I'd love you to give a summary of what you were trying to do and why you were trying to do it.
That's a very good question. The origin of that idea was not really mine. One of my twins was at Harvard and graduated with a degree in neuroscience and had obtained a fellowship to go study art restoration in Italy for a year, which I thought was an amazing idea, mostly because he had mentioned he wanted to study art. And I had told him, on your own money, you can do whatever you want. And he found this fellowship and went to Italy, majored in art restoration, or worked in art restoration, and then went on to medical school, et cetera. But I like the idea of being able to have someone allow you the freedom and the space to find something meaningful. Kids go through the pressure cookers of school and high school and college without really time to breathe, to look up and say, what would I like to do next? And so I came to MIT, my alma mater, which I had not given very much. I think I'd given the regular $100, $50 a year. And I said, I would like to establish a fund whereby students upon graduation from MIT can go abroad or here in the U.S., anywhere they want, and do something for a year while they decide what they want to do later on in life. One department said, no, we don't do that. Another department said, why don't you go to the foreign student's office? Why don't you go to study abroad? Those were not the projects I was interested in. And in a fit of wrath, to use the word loosely, I called a member of the board of directors of MIT, and he said, where are you? I said, I'm in building 7. MIT's buildings all have names, numbers. And he said, wait for about 10 minutes. And down comes the chairman of the physics department. We walked around. I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, look, I've got a much better idea. Instead of letting the students wander around all over the world, why don't we do something else? Why don't you establish a fund for students whom we've accepted into the physics department for the PhD and come here, but don't know quite what field to get into in physics? So give them the possibility of a year at MIT at the PhD level. These are people who've been vetted by the institution, and they'll be able to find what they would really like to do. And I thought that was a brilliant idea. It fulfilled a couple of needs. One is give students the time to find their passion in life without having the financial pressures. And by the same token, it allowed me a connection to the world of science. And I thought it was a very interesting issue. The important thing there is that I want to stress the fact that the chairman of the physics department was able to A, identify the willingness on the part of the potential donor to give, B, listened carefully to what the donor wanted to do, and C, said, let's make a match. And it requires, I think, a great deal of human finesse to really listen carefully. It was not a menu, a la carte, pick A, B, C, choice of salad, dessert, and beverage, but rather what can we make for you? And it worked beautifully. And that's been the reason for that gift. And it's continued. And my wife and I are very happy, very proud donors of this. And as a matter of fact, we're so happy because there's a connection, but also because there's a feeling that this is something we really like. Now, the important thing about that is that I'm talking about as a family, give to three things. Causes we believe in, and these are long-term causes. Then we have opportunities. It's a one-time, somebody tells you, I would like to do this, or the other, you give to that. And then there's a third bucket called because I have to. And those buckets we all have. But the first idea is causes we believe in with a passion, with a long-term commitment is very important. And MIT was able to read this and say, this is what you would like. Let's establish a fellowship. Let's continue doing it year after year after year. That I thought was important.
So you really have a deep relationship then, I know, with physics at MIT because of your gift. They've taken you in, you've taken them into your heart and really serve as companions on the journey to help the students that you're helping.
Yes, yes, and with great pride. Now, for the benefit of the audience, I really don't understand 95% of the things they tell me. So, like, don't think that physics is, like, that easy, okay? But it's important that we settle that. But yes.
Despite your brilliance.
Despite the brilliance. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you, as a family, make philanthropic decisions. And I know you have several kids, so you still, with your adult children, make decisions philanthropically as a group?
Teresa, that's a good question. We started the idea of philanthropy many, many years ago when the children were little. And it was the Friday after Thanksgiving when the family was together and we were all present and calm and sitting down. And we'd say, okay, what are we going to give to and what is our budget for the year? It was a very small budget, but what is the budget for next year? And what does each person want to give to and why? And it ranged from a small gift to the zoo for the baby lot, for the baby seals, to a slightly larger gift to the Florida Youth Symphony, whatever the children were interested in. And we felt that was important because as a family, we were able to share what is important. So when a five-year-old or a six-year-old tells you, I would like to give my share to this and tells you why, it becomes very interesting. At the time, the six-year-old, five-year-old said, how will I know they used my money for the baby seals? Oh, that was a good question. So we set up an appointment the following Sunday to go to the Seaquarium and talk to the keepers of the seals, and the children learned the concept of accountability. And we did not use that word, but rather the concept, how will I know that you're using my $12 to feed the baby seals? So that was very important. And that continued over the years. So we said, what do we give to as a family from when they were little? The causes that we are passionate about, the leaders that we really, really like, and that we have some sense of involvement. And we've done this all our lives, well, since the children were very little. And now that my granddaughters are like coming of age at the age of 5 and thereabouts, is to start with them as well. What would you like to give to and why? And make them defend their positions. So yes, we do that as a family, as the causes.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Because I like your examples, because we're not talking about necessarily a lot of money in the case of giving to the zoo, but the act of kindness and the accountability and the impact of the gift is demonstrated to your kids and now their kids. That's That's wonderful that you teach that within the family. I think all of us as fundraisers would love if everybody would do that.
Yes, but also shows the children something else. This is what we believe in as a family. These are our core values, and these are things we learn at home. at the dinner table that we learn on Saturdays and Sundays. And so just continue emphasizing, we believe in this. If the children are playing the orchestra, we give to music. If the children are little, well, whatever it is they're doing, let's make sure that the message delivered at home is consistent with the charity we're giving to.
That's interesting, because I'm working with a youth orchestra in Boston right now. And I wonder, you know, families are very involved, but I wonder if the parents are having conversations about the gifts that they're making to the youth orchestra with their children who are, of course, benefiting from it. That would be interesting for them to introduce as a concept among the parents. Like, do you talk about your philanthropic giving with your kids to teach them or help them make the decisions about where the money goes, and then in the process teach them about philanthropy?
Yes, Teresa, you're right. And also, I think it's very important to teach the children that we will support a cause over a period of years. And they need to understand there's a sense of commitment. You don't have to have give to the same cause every year. Maybe some years a cause will drop out for A, B, C, or D. But we will continue to the, well, maybe an institution will drop out. Maybe the zoo decided not to have seals this year anymore, whatever. But we will give to animal care. We will give to music. We will give to science. And it's important that there's a sense of continuity. There's not the flavor of the jour. This year we'll give to this, next year we'll give to the other. No, we're going to be consistent in what we give to. I think it's important to stress that.
Ricardo, I have to ask. Yeah. You've got to turn back the clock a little bit more than where you've already gone. Did you learn this from your parents, or was this a value that you and your wife sort of came to early in your marriage? Where does this deliberateness and intentionality come from?
Jason, that's a very interesting question. I was thinking about it this morning. My parents had a very small charity box in the hallway at the entrance of our house, into which you put coins.
Yeah.
But this was not random loose change from your pockets. No, you walked up, and you took some coins out of your pocket to put into the charity box. We're talking about little coins, okay? But there was a concept that you have to give a little bit. It was not big. It was very small. It was like pennies, plural. I don't think we got to dimes that big. But the concept that one must give. And there was the concept that you should give to someone whom you do not know. And the person who receives it should not know who gave you the funds. It's got to be double blind. You don't want to start targeting. You want to give it to the needy regardless. So we started there. But this was very, very small. What happened with my wife's and I decision to fundraise, we were very, very, very fortunate in business in the dot-com bubble. And somebody came to speak to us and said, would you consider making a gift? And we went, maybe. And what are the criteria under which you would give? And it took us about 2 years of going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until we finally settled on, this would be a very fun thing if we involved the children. And so it started, I'd say, into our marriage when the children are already like grade school type age.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a coming of age. It was a when the idea reached its maturity in our minds, this is how we would like to do it. Because once you know how you would like to do it, to what you give it to is much, much easier. But what is a mechanism? It became very easy. And you and I know very well that it's very easy, very convenient to give to the first cause that asks. And I don't want to mention names, but we know who they are. And they ask and you give and you felt you gave. Did it really make a difference to you personally? Did it really motivate you to say, I am a part of this and I'm proud to belong? And that was nice. Does that answer your question, Jason?
It does. Go back to one other detail. I've got to understand that the three buckets that you described, because we talk about that here at Responsive a little bit about the sort of various buckets that people give their giving in. You described sort of that priority box.
Yes.
Where some of those most, you know, where those most deeply held, most appreciated sort of causes exist. And then there were sort of the one-off contributions. And then there was sort of the obligatory box.
Yes.
Just without prying into actual numbers, on any given annual year, where would you say on a percentage basis, which of those boxes, how much of your giving is going to each one of those boxes on, say, an annualized basis?
Jason, that's a very, very, very important question. On the because we have to category, make it about 20%.
Okay. Okay, gotcha. Right.
The opportunity is about, I'd say, on the order of 10 to 15%.
Yeah.
And the cause we believe in is 70%. And yeah. Because we have to is high for a very simple reason. When your friends or your colleagues say, "Can I count on you for this?" These are the people you see on a daily basis, whether it be socially, or in business, or in any group you belong to, you want to be able to say, yes, I'll be part of your cause. So socially becomes very important to support your friends in causes that you think are valid. But yes, because we have to, has to be a high proportion.
Sure. So Ricardo, there's a study, and I refer to this study when we do and Teresa knows this, she's probably referred to it herself. In our seminar, we referred to a 2006 study. It was called the Significant Gift Study. And it was largely done in healthcare. And they basically found it's beautiful that essentially you line up perfectly with that, but about 2/3 of any household's giving goes to those most significant commitments. And then in our frameworks, we sort of have two similar other pots that we see people giving to. But it's interesting to hear you say that 70%, 65 to 70% of any dollar that you give philanthropically in any calendar year is going to go first to fulfill that commitment to those most important causes.
Jason, you used the word commitment, and I need to stress the importance of that. Gifts have to be, in my opinion, long-term commitments, regardless of the amount. For a very simple reason, you need to feel part of that cause. You need to feel ownership of that cause. But by the same token, the institution needs to know that they can count on you year after year for support. And I'll give you another example. There's a institution, a person that we met last year and was discussing the work that she's doing. And I said, well, how long do you think it's going to take you to come up with this solution? And she said, I'd say about 4 to 5 years, 3 to 5 years. I said, I'll tell you what, we will fund you for 5 years because I do not want you having to go out every year in search for funds. We want to take care of it. You just deal with your work. We'll make sure that your lights are on. And it's important to stress that each cause has something to do. They have their mission statement. They have their purpose. And scrounging for money should not be the main function of the professionals. That's what the donors are for.
Especially when they're looking for other planets in the solar system, right, Ricardo?
but we found over 5,000.
Right.
so then they come, well, now we're going to look for life on other planets. Well, that's fun. Okay. But yes, you're right. These are things that take time. And regardless of the amount you're going to give, tell the institution, I will give you whatever number you want, $100, whatever number you want. But you know what? Count on me for 3 to 5 years. And continue your work. And Jason used the word commitment very, very, very appropriately when it comes to as a donor.
Your other life at MIT was as a volunteer. and you held two significant positions, which I'm sure gave you a viewpoint pretty much of the whole spectrum of giving with donors. And one was as the head of the annual fund board, and the other was in South Florida, a member of something called the Corporation Development Committee, which is working alongside a major gift officer in identifying, cultivating, and soliciting your fellow alumni, parents, and friends of MIT in your area. I'm curious what you learned in all of that as a volunteer, and what kept you doing it? Why were you so committed to it?
Teresa, first, and I need to repeat this as many times as you want, it was the pleasure of working with a very, very high caliber staff of professionals, of which you were the head. Okay, so it was a pleasure. Having said that, once I was able to see that there are very good causes, it became very easy to go visit fellow alums with whom we have things in common and to say, you know what? I got involved, and this is what I did. Could I interest you in doing something similar? Whatever interests you, whether it's rocketry or nanomanufacturing or cryptography, could I interest you? And there's a common bond when the volunteer comes to visit you because there are stories you can tell. There's a common language. There's a common way of being. So it became easy. That was very important. So now we have the issue that I can talk by example of, this is what I did. You don't need to mention numbers, but say, I've done this, which brought me a lot of satisfaction. Would you be interested in doing something that would appeal to you? That was the first thing. But the other thing that was very important is that I had the pleasure of working with a very serious professional with whom we set up we drew a circle. We're very good at drawing circles at MIT, with or without a compass. And we had a volunteer, the professionals, the donor, and institution. And they are all interrelated, and they all revolve around the common cause. Once you understood that, it was very, very easy to talk to a donor in the company of a professional and listen. What is the donor really interested in? And what is MIT really interested in? How do we meld the two ideas together like they did in my case? And then came the second part of the story. Once the professional left, and she was extremely good, is the follow-up visit. Now it's just one-on-one with the donor and the spouse. Always involve the spouse in these decisions. With the donor and the spouse, and say, well, how did you feel about it? Do you have any ideas? Let's continue. Remember that in the case of my wife and I, it took us roughly 2 years to decide how we're going to do this. You need to involve the spouse at every step of the discussion. For many people, charitable giving is a substantial portion of the family budget, the discretionary family budget. Make sure that the spouse is also on the same page as to the cause and the purpose and the recognition. And we learned that very, very early on. So once you're working with the professional and the donor and the volunteer institution, you learn to listen very carefully, not what your agenda was. What is the donor's agenda? How do you follow through? The other point is the issue of continuity. A professional fundraiser and a professional donor volunteer need to be working hand in hand over a period of years to develop trust, to develop the same approach, to develop the same philosophy. So again, in continuity in giving, but also continuity in working. What I really learned from Teresa was the importance of analytics in fundraising. With Teresa and I would have a weekly phone call in which we, as a chair of the annual fund, would get the reports of week to date, year to date, and the last 5 years, broken out into many categories, and very finely sliced, to be able to see where opportunities lay and what areas were in danger. So the importance of analytics was very, very, very critical. And we learned this together with the professional staff. So as a volunteer, as a leader, is the importance of listening, but also learning. Learning from our peers, from the professionals, and from our peer institutions. What are the good practices? What are the best practices? Who do we have to beat?
Hey, without naming any names, you know, what was the biggest lesson you learned, let's say, visiting fellow alumni in South Florida about philanthropy, or even about their relationship to the institution? You know, did you have any surprises, any big wins?
Yes.
And by that, I don't mean the amount of money, but just sort of turning somebody around who otherwise was maybe at a distance.
Yes, that, I'm glad you asked that question. That's, and it wasn't planted either.
No.
There was an alum who had given exactly zero to MIT, zero. And I knew he had been successful, and I knew he'd sold his business, and I knew he'd retired in a very nice area of South Florida. I went to visit him, and he told me in very, very sincere terms, I hated MIT. I hated every minute of MIT. I hated it with a passion. Oh, but you did stay for the 4 years and you graduated. He says, well, yes, very gruffly, yes. There must have been something you liked. And he said, well, actually, the Symphony Orchestra was fun. Oh, really? Yes, because it was the only time that he could relax and be himself and play and be with other people. And a long story, roughly, we're compressing 2 hours into a few seconds. Would you be willing to receive a visit from the director of the symphony, of the MIT Symphony? Yes. The visit was arranged, and a major, major donation came from that for other students who are in the MIT Symphony who might benefit from instruments or music scores or chairs, whatever, but it was something that he, it was the only fond memory he had of his education there. You know what? Let's make it beautiful. Let's celebrate it. And I cannot tell you the importance of that message when he said, yes, I actually enjoyed something. It was the symphony.
That is awesome. I have had similar conversations, not just with MIT alumni, but alumni of other schools where you know, you arrive and they kind of unload everything they didn't like or everything they're angry about. And you take it in because that's your job. But also you take it in as a human being to say, this isn't the totality of their relationship. It couldn't be, which you recognize, because they did stay and they did graduate and they are successful. So there's got to be some credit due to the institution that they did learn from.
And then you
do pivot and try to get them to go to a happy place in their brain. And one of the things that I always like to say was, how did you feel when you got in? Oh, that was a great moment, they'll say, because everybody's excited, right? They chose that school. So it's important to take people and let them air their grievances and all of that. I'm a big fan of that. Get it out. Get it off their chest.
Absolutely.
But then get them to a fond memory or a happy place, if there is one, and there usually is.
Teresa, but you also have to be very careful as a volunteer is to manage expectations. When the donor says, okay, I will give however I would like, well, this is not a quid pro quo. And you're not buying a privilege. We are going to use your philanthropy to further our causes. Let there be no mistake about it. And no, you're not going to get a special parking spot when you come to visit us on graduation day. We don't do that. You laugh because we had that issue. Okay. But you need to manage expectations. We are very happy. We're working together. We have fond memories. You'll get our magazines. What kind of recognition would you like? But let's manage the expectation. And when it comes to recognition, it's not just the updates and bronze cup you receive, but it's a human connection. In addition to your sending the donor a thank you note and a phone call, have the recipient send the handwritten note. For example, if you funded some, if you send money for the scholarship fund, ask the students to write a handwritten note, and it can go to as many donors as gave to that fund. Handwritten note can be copied with a picture and say, you know, you made my research possible. Thank you very much. And send the note. The human connection is far more important than the object you sent. And there's something I need to stress, though. If you believe in the cause as a donor, as a volunteer, if you believe in the cause, then it becomes a very easy ask. Look at what I did, and we've been through this together. Would you like to come along with me? It becomes a very easy ask. And when the professional understands that it's an easy ask, the relationship is so smooth.
So I want you to put – oh, go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, Ricardo, I have to help me with something. So I teach some courses over at our local college here. And occasionally I get into this conversation with my students about the way that the nonprofit sector, different than the government and different than the private sector, the nonprofit sector has not sort of yet to still seems to sort of still seems to be unable to sort of reconcile the way that money sort of exchanges hands. They still don't sort of understand that it's essentially the process of what we're doing is largely, you know, expressing gratitude and or expressing generosity and then expressing gratitude in exchange for that or something, and I wonder if managing those so hinging the idea of sort of managing those expectations, if we trace that idea all the way back to that little box that your parents had you put coins in as a child, it is part of the problem that we have in philanthropy. That we don't understand that philanthropy and generosity and gratitude trace all the way back to things such as that. The way in which your parents encouraged you to put coins in that little box is not the same way that they would have paid their taxes to the government. And it's not the same way that they would have gone to the grocery store and purchased cereal and milk. It was a completely different underlying assumption about what that money meant and what we were going to do with it. Do you sort of follow the sort of the uncertainty and the sort of the, what I'm trying to reconcile for my students?
Yes, yes. And I would like to address it two ways. One, putting coins in the box made noise. So you knew the coin had fallen. The coin had dropped. So there was a sensory feedback that you had given and the box recognized the gift.
Sure.
Which the sensory part is very important. Clink, clink, the coin drop. But the other thing is this. All told, Americans gave last year roughly $400 billion with a B dollars to nonprofits and faith organizations and charities and the like. That's 2% of our GDP, gross domestic product. That number has not budged in four decades.
Right.
So Americans continue to give very generously what we've always given, 2% of GDP. And so we need to understand that the nation as a whole is generous. People do want to give. The problem is that there are many more organizations to give today, and that many organizations are becoming much savvier in how they ask for money. So it's the same number of dollars, but the pie has expanded enormously. So each slice is smaller and you have the element of choices. So people still give at a constant 2% of GDP. We still give.
Yes.
There are more people competing for the same dollars. I think the number is like $2,500 per family per year.
Yeah.
Well, okay. It hasn't changed, but you have many more organizations chasing those same dollars with more sophisticated marketing techniques. So is it a question of education? Of course it's a question of education. But I think the education has to be more focused towards what do we believe in rather than just randomly whoever asks for money. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, do we, are we, I guess my question is philanthropy too guilty of trying to behave like the government and tax our people, you know, do like your obligation box, like your obligation bucket, or are we too often trying to sell people things like the supermarket does? And can we get to the place where we understand on the receiving side that that charitable gift is a completely different occurrence? It's a completely different human behavior than the human behavior that I exhibit when I pay my taxes and when I go and buy a widget from the department store. And it seems to me like if we understood if more fundraisers understood the narrative that you shared 20 minutes ago about the way in which your family was giving, I think we'd be a whole heck of a lot better fundraisers. And I think we'd raise a whole lot more money and we'd push we'd nudge that percentage of GDP up higher. But I don't think there's enough of us that understand that your family sat around that table, regardless of how much money was actually being, you know, distributed, given away. It's that we don't understand that happens and why that matters.
Jason, your point is very well taken, because you mentioned the three criteria is the taxation by charity, the discretionary shopping, or just giving.
Yes.
However, there's two other factors. Very often philanthropy calls for two reasons. A, they want to make you feel guilty that you have not given.
Right.
And the second is that they have a need and they want your money. And we have to remember that philanthropy has to focus on the pleasure of giving and that people give to causes. People do not like to give to needs.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a distinction that we need to change. It's the pleasure of giving, the pleasure of being part of it, and also the fact that it's a cause in which I believe in. Now, it's very simple. When you give to an organization and they say, we would like $1,000, what for? Well, we have to maintain the lights and we have to clean the hallways. Oh, I don't want to give to maintenance. No, wait. The entire organization runs on a budget. What we're seeking is for you to relieve pressure from our budget so that we can carry on with our mission. And that has to be conveyed. It's not guilt. It's not needs. This is the greater cause. It's a pleasure to belong. And that's why volunteers are so effective, because we can identify better with a potential donor. And volunteers can be found everywhere. Who was your previous donor? And we're not talking about the big donors. They don't have time. Get the small, the medium donor and say, listen, you know what? I want to make a phone call. Would you mind being on the call with me? And you'd be surprised how many people will feel so honored that somebody asked, would you be on a call with the professional? And again, don't go for the big donors. Go for the small, the medium donors who were happy, A, that they gave, and B, that they're being recognized. That's important.
Teresa, yeah. how do we get one more nugget of wisdom out of Ricardo before we wrap this up?
Yeah. Well, Ricardo, because you have worked so closely with professionals, and you've seen several of us do what we do, I'm sure you've been in a position to maybe disagree or want to give us feedback about our work so that we are more effective to all of your points that you've made during our conversation, that you know, your viewpoint in that moment is as a fellow donor, a fellow alum, or a fellow peer of whomever you're speaking to. Where have we gotten it right and where have we gone very wrong? And how do you open up and give feedback, or how do we as professionals get that feedback from you, our volunteers?
Teresa, that is a very good question, which I will answer from my many, many years running companies and many, 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 many employees. Management has to be direct, clear, and concise as to what is expected. There can be no hidden agendas, no hidden meanings, nothing that the staff feels uncomfortable discussing. And then as a leader, encourage frank and open discussion upfront with the professionals. This is what we did. Let's analyze it. We should have gotten these results. How can we change them? What did I do wrong? What can be improved? Be very upfront and open. You cannot have a professional going home at night wondering what happened during the day and being terrorized at coming to work the next morning because the professional does not know what to expect in the workplace. Be clear, upfront, say it today and get it cleared so that you don't go home at night worrying about your job, your position, your prospects in at work. And this has to be brought in by volunteers who have experience outside, who've dealt with people and who understand the importance of being very honest, very clear, very direct, and consistent day after day. So just like you share with your family, these are the core values of a family. In a company, in an organization, these are our core values. And we listen to our people, encourage discussions. One of the things that we're noticing in these Zoom talks now is that you don't have a table, and therefore you don't have somebody sitting at the head of the table. Everybody's on the screen, more or less in the same positions. And so the idea of hierarchy has vanished. Jason, I want to mention the issue of head of the table, which has nothing to do with this discussion. But at one of our meetings, I noticed that Teresa had seated us in a certain way around the table. And I noted, asked her why. I said, well, we're putting the older people closer to the screen because they can't see well.
Did I say that? So, I don't remember.
Those little things. People perceive as, wow, that was very nice of you. I can see the board so well. This was very nice. There was a purpose to the way the organization treated the volunteers, and that was highly appreciated.
You must have been at the back of the room. You weren't the old guy.
I was at the front. I was at the front. Definitely at the front.
Okay. Ricardo, if we keep going, we'll lose our listeners. We lose them at about 45 minutes. They usually they don't usually sit with us that long. But if somebody is listening to our conversation today, they know how to find Teresa and I, but they say they want to find you and they want to continue the conversation in some way or another. How would you suggest that they do that?
Very good. They can get in touch with either Teresa or you. And both of you have my contact info. You have my phone number. You can call me anytime you wish, and it'd be a pleasure to talk to anybody who would like to follow up. You've got my contact info anytime.
Thank you, Ricardo. It has been a pleasure. This has probably been the highlight of my week. I have enjoyed this conversation, and I will probably be reminiscing on it quite a bit as we continue. Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.